The Seder Ve'erah is a continuation of the previous chapter. It starts at chapter 6, verse 2. The previous chapter, the ending of Shema, Moshe had complained to Hashem that from the time that he had come to the children of Israel to fulfill this mission, the times had turned against them even more so, and they were given harder labor. So Hashem answered him, now is the time that the real Exodus will start moving. Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. And then in verse 2, Hashem says to Moshe, chapter 6, verse 2, I am Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. You will now see the power of the name of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, that Hashem is the total master over all of creation. And then he continues in sentence 3, and I appeared, he says, to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov with the name of Keol Shakai, Ushmi Hashem Lo Nadati Lahem. I appeared to them with the name Keol Shakai. In a way, this was a reproach to Moshe, meaning that when I appeared to the fathers of Israel, they never questioned, the Medrash says, I appeared to them, and they never questioned my decrees. But you had called out, Lomo of Esau, Lomo Zeh Shalachtoni, why have you punished these people? Why did you send me? And actually by sending me, matters became much worse for them. So now, just one aspect of this. It seems that the Ovis had complete faith in Hashem, and Moshe somehow, who was called Ish Elokim, the man of God, who had the greatest prophecy, Moshe somehow was lacking in this faith. What is the difference? Why the Ovos didn't question God, and to a degree Moshe did. So some of the Mefarshim point out the difference was, there are many answers, but some say that the difference was that Moshe here was a leader of a group of God's people. The Ovos was basically, it involved their own personal life, the trials, the tribulations that they had in their life. So then, whatever faith meted out to them, a person who is a righteous, spiritual person, a believer in God, accepted faithfully, without question, anything that God gave them. But Moshe here was not a question of Moshe petitioning God for his own benefit or for his own salvation. It wasn't a personal test here at all. He was a leader of people, and Moshe couldn't stand by and accept the injustices that he saw that were being done by the Egyptians. So, in a sense, he was risking his life, but he was ready to risk his life on behalf of Klal Yisrael. There's an idea that even if it was necessary, we'll say, to question God and to speak in a way which Moshe as a person would never speak and intercede on his own behalf in that fashion, yet when it dealt for other people, so he went ahead and he did intercede. In a way that, people always like to ask, why didn't Avram intercede on the Akedah for Yitzchak, whereas he did intercede on behalf of the people of Sodom. But really, the Akedah of Yitzchak was a test of Avram. It was the test of Avram personally. Test of Avram personally, who was he to barter with God? But here you were dealing with the people of Sodom, meaning a community of people. So then as a leader, there we see that Avram did petition God. And he said, how could you go ahead? Chalil alecha lohamis tzadik im rasha. But he did question. So the difference being that Moshe, in this chapter especially, Moshe was representing Klal Yisrael. In the same vein, there's a famous saying from Yisrael Salanter. He says, every idea that you find in this world has its purpose. He says, an unbeliever in God, an apikeres, an unbeliever in God, also can be used in a positive fashion. Why? If somebody comes along and tells you something, don't say, have faith in God, I can't help you, but you have faith in God. No, when it's involving helping somebody else, you could be an apikeres. You could say, no, I will help you, and don't put off the other person with bitach on itself. So in the same vein here also, Moshe was representing Klal Yisrael. Now, therefore, God, to a degree, didn't reproach him, but in one view of the Medrash, he did, in a sense, reprimand him by saying that you should have faith in me because I revealed myself to you with Hashem. Hashem meaning that I change all forces of nature, almost recreation if necessary. So if I guaranteed you that that power is going to be used, a nes goli, meaning a open miracle, which if it's necessary, there are all kinds of miracles. The whole world exists on miracles. Everything is miracle. But I said that I would actually change the forces of nature if necessary and show openly that all should see my dominion. So there's nothing that will stop Hashem because he's going to say that he's going to do that. So he says, the Avos, I never told them that. I appeared to them, Bikael Shakai, Shin Dalad Yud, meaning everything within, hidden within nature. But here, and I promised them, but here I've guaranteed you that I would do anything, and that you still go ahead and you question. So these are some of the ideas that are presented in the beginning of the era, that indeed Moshe didn't seem to be so out of order in a petitioning Hashem. At the same time, God did rebuke Moshe indirectly by saying that since he had guaranteed him that these miracles would occur with the Shem Hashem, Moshe really should not have questioned this. Now in verse, he continues, L'chein emor, in verse 6, tell the children of Israel that I will redeem them out of Egypt with an outstretched arm. And verse 7 is, V'lekachti eschem li la'on, they will be to me to a people, and I will be for them to a God. And they will recognize that I indeed am the one that brought them out of Egypt. In verse 8 it says, I will also bring them into the land that I had lifted up and sworn to our forefathers that they will come into that land. So I am prepared now to go ahead and to expedite and bring this to fruition, to fulfillment. Now, the question asked, really, the Yerachayim asks a very good question. How could he say here in sentence 8, there's a guarantee that I will bring you into the land, meaning say this to the children of Israel. But the truth was that the Hevesi of sentence 8 did not take place because the ones that went out of Mitzrayim, they were killed out in the Midbar. So if we say that God had given him his word, so it seems that something was very difficult. And not only that, the Chazal interpret the word of Lochein and more Livnei Yisrael. The word Lochein in Ani Hashem, Beitzesi, which is said earlier in 6, Lochein and more Livnei Yisrael is a shvuah, meaning that the word Lochein is an oath. So God had given his oath that the Beitzesi of sentence 8, I will bring you into the land. If he gave them actually an oath, how in any way can he go ahead and change this? So the Arachayim says a very interesting answer. He says before the verse, if you look at the verse, right, it first says in 6 and 7 that I will take you, the four languages of redemption, Otsesi, I will take you out of, which is in verse 6, correct? Itzalti, meaning I will save you, deliver you, also in 6. Goalti, redeem you. These are three expressions. We'll speak shortly. That's why we drink the cups of wine. The fourth expression is in verse 7, Vilakachti, I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you for a God. And then there is an extra phrase put in, and then in verse 8, you have the Evesi, I will bring you down to Eretz Yisrael. So the Arachayim says the following. If this extra phrase, if you note, what is it? The Adata, after I've done these four things, you will then know that I am God who brought you out of the affliction of Egypt. Then, Ve'evesi Eschem, I will bring you into Eretz Yisrael. So this was put in the middle of the oath to say that it's dependent. After I've done all four things for you, I've taken you out and I've redeemed you and chosen you for a people through Sinai. You then have an obligation to know that I am the God that took you out of Egypt. But if later in the wilderness of Paran they went against God, so they did not learn the lesson of the four. So therefore, verse 8, which says, V'yavesi eschem, was yet not applicable. He didn't bring them in, because the first four languages of redemption was l'chein, was an oath. But the word of V'yavesi in verse 8, that really depends upon the actions and the behavior and the recognition of the children of Israel. Like, if you will know that indeed I am the God, then I will bring you into Eretz Yisrael. So that's the way the Arachaim answers that, that there is a separation between the four expressions of redemption and really the fifth expression of redemption, which is coming into Eretz. Now, the next point is, you know, we have, based on these four languages or expressions, I mean, four expressions, language, we have the four cups of wine. V'etzesi, v'hitzalti, v'goalti, and v'lokafti. Now we go ahead and we take a fifth cup of wine. And what do we call that fifth cup of wine? The cup of Eliyahu Hanavi. Now the Vilna Gaon said, what's the reason why we say this is the cup of Eliyahu Hanavi, that bringing into Eretz Yisrael? So he says, the reason is because there's a dispute in the Gemara if you need a fifth cup or not. Some say yes, some say not. What you always find in the Gemara when it's a dispute that's unanswered. So the Gemara says, Teiku, that means Eliyahu HaNavi will provide the answer for us. That's how you always find in the Talmud. So this fifth cup, which we place over here, this we call the cup of Eliyahu, because we don't know if we should drink the fifth cup or not. So that's what he said, that's the reason why it's called the cup of Eliyahu. We always think that the cup alludes to the future redemption. But if it really is the redemption, why is it the fifth cup? I mean, we still have, there are people that are still not fulfilled the first four cups. So there is a question, if it's five, why the fifth cup? So why did you name it Eliyahu HaNavi? So he said, because Eliyahu, when he comes, will explain us all the snakes, like we find throughout the Talmud, all the questions, all the disputes, what the proper answer is. So when he comes, he will answer this fifth cup, if this fifth cup is necessary or not. Now, the idea of why did they choose wine, that we find also among the commentaries. Why did they choose wine? So some say because expressions of love we find in Shir HaShirim, Naskira Deidecha B'Yayin, that you express love, expressions of love are somehow expressed with wine. And we find in scriptures the ideas, always speaking of closeness, it uses wine. But in the Meshech Chochma, Meir Simcha said that perhaps the idea of the four cups of wine is because the reason why the Jew was worthy of redemption from Egypt was because they separated themselves, because they did not become assimilated. We said there was no intermarriage and so on, to a degree, they did not assimilate themselves. Now, wine has always been symbolic of the, it always has come to the glass of wine, which is the test of the separation of Klal Yisrael from the non-Jew. And somehow he brings down the non-Jew always recognized this, because when Haman came to Achashverosh and he wanted to speak against the children of Israel, so what did he tell Achashverosh? In order to aggravate him, to get him to become angry, so he says, you know, if a cup of wine is given to you and somebody else, you would drink a little bit of this wine, or you would touch this wine, the Jews would take the wine and spill it out. But if a fly would fall into the wine, they'd just take out the fly and they'd drink the rest of the wine. So somehow this wine, Haman was depicting, was a separation or between the Jew and the non-Jew. And also the whole idea that we find in Halacha, there's so much about wine that the Gzeira, the decree, you know, that the rabbis made, not when they used to use it on the altar, but what we call kosher wine now. What is the kosher wine? It's exactly the same wine as any other wine. There is no difference. The only difference is that it wasn't touched by a non-Jew. So you see, why did they make this decree that it wasn't touched by a non-Jew? Because the Gemara says, Mishum b'nosehem, because they didn't want you to intermarry. Now, of course, you could drink cocktails with the non-Jew socially, and the wine, the famous Yayin Mevushal wine. What is the idea of Mevushal wine? The Mevushal wine means that kind of wine never went into the original decree, because that wine would not be the type of wine that is held in such esteem, because that was never spilt on the altar. So it wasn't the actual epitome of wine, and therefore they didn't make the decree on something that is mevushal. Now that's why you have wines that are not mevushal. There are a lot of people that insist on getting wine which is not mevushal to use for Yiddish, because for the purpose of a mitzvah they would like to use wine that is not mevushal. But it's better from a practical point of view to have wine that is mevushal. But the purpose of all of that was to make a separation, that it shouldn't lead to assimilation. The same idea of bread, Pas Yisroel. What is Pas Yisroel? There are different laws dealing with that. But also it was that there shouldn't be assimilation. If you eat the bread, the bishulakum, the idea that the non-Jew cooks without... So these were all made as barriers, but the one that is the classic example really was the social, it still is in most of the world, the primary social drink is not a cup of coffee or a bottle of beer, but basically a glass of wine. And the more expensive, delicate the wine, the greater the essence of it is. So therefore, the Mesher Chochmah says the concept of taking the four cups of wine relating to the four languages of redemption is because this teaches us symbolically, it makes a symbolism that the reason why we were worthy of redemption is because we, like Chazal say, because we lived differently, we didn't intermarry with them, although spiritually many Jews had succumbed to idolatry, but they kept this separation, and this brought about the fact that they were worthy of redemption. Now, the Torah continues into chapter 7, and it tells Moshe that you are over Pharaoh, Nisaticho, I have made you, in chapter 7, verse 1, I have made you a master over Pharaoh, and therefore I want you to prove this mastery. Now, before Moshe approached Pharaoh, there's just an interesting idea. In chapter 6, verse 13, you don't have to go back, but I'll read it to you there. It says that God spoke to Moshe, Vaitzaveim, and he commanded them concerning the children of Israel and Pharaoh Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt. So they asked, what did he command them about? He commanded them about children of Israel to go ahead and get them out of Egypt. But what does it mean, Vaitzaveim Melech Mitzrayim? The rabbis tell us that what he meant there was Vaitzaveim Melech Mitzrayim, that they have to have respect when they speak to Pharaoh. You would think they're going in to speak to Pharaoh now. So how do you address Pharaoh? You go in to address him, you totalitarian state, you're a racist, you're an anti-Semite, you're this and you're that. Let my people go with force. So he says, no, you have to, even in the moment of wrath and anger, and when you're going to a king, be a melech, can be a melech, not a Jewish melech, but you have to go ahead and deal with their acheret, kavo. So Gemara says, the idea is here, that siva or love, lachlo, the Medrash says, lo kavo bidivrehem. Never to lose themselves when they approach the melech, but always to speak with respect, only because he's the melech, being that he's a tyrant and so on. Now, we find the same idea, the Gemara says, also, it says in the morning, we find later in chapter 7, it says in the morning, go to Pharaoh as he goes out to the water. So what does it mean, likrosso, it says, go greet Pharaoh when he goes to the water. So the Gemara says, what does it mean, likrosso, greet him? It means go give him a message, what's likrosso, greet him, the term greet him. So Rabbi Yochanan says that he's a king, and he's berlei ponim, give him the proper respect when you go to speak to him. And the same idea was, furthermore, in Makas Bechoris, in next week's chapter, in chapter 11, in Makas Bechoris, he tells Pharaoh, this is the last time. You're going to come to me now. But he doesn't say, you're going to come to me. What he did mean was that Pharaoh will come saying, where's Moshe? Let him go. And Pharaoh did go himself. But Moshe, when he spoke to him, the Gemara says he wouldn't say that, you're going to come to bow to me. But he said, V'yordu kol avodecho elai. All of your servants will come begging to me. He didn't want to say that you will come begging. He came, your servants will come begging. And we know that what happened at the end. Pharaoh came and said to Moshe, Kume Tzei, you could leave. But Moshe meant Pharaoh to come, but he had to speak with respect. And we also find there by Yosef, when they took him out of the dungeon, it says, Vaygalech Vaychalev Simlosov. They didn't care less, I once mentioned. They were in a hurry to find the answer to the dream. They didn't care if he came up wearing his prison denims and if he had a five-day growth of stubble. Let's hear what he has to say. But Yosef, no. Vayritzu, it says then. My Rebbe emphasized that. Vayritzu, they hurried him up. They just went. But he said, no. Vaygalech Vaychalev Simlosov. When he comes to the face of royalty, he has to appear in a proper fashion. So even under such circumstances, and this really gives us an appreciation what the Torah is, it takes the person under the most severe circumstances and it governs his actions and teaches him their affairs, even like this. Now, for example, we know that we make a bracha. When you see a non-Jewish king, you're making a bracha. Not only a non-Jewish king, even a governor, somebody who doesn't, like a president of the United States, somebody who doesn't have a power over him. Now, also, we know that we say prayers for Malchus. So these are things, why do we do this? For peace. In fact, they point out that the words, Shenosan, the blessing is, Shenosan, Mikvodo, that he is given from his honor, Lebosor Vedom, to a flesh and bones. So when you take this, they point out the Kaf HaChaim, you take the first letter of each of these words, Shin, Lamed, Vav, Mem, which means Shalom. Mipnei Shalom, they were mitaken to make this bracha. So then that was the idea of Moshe giving him the proper respect. So then he continues into the next chapter, that when you come to Pharaoh, God says, Ani Akshe, slave Pharaoh, I will strengthen the heart of Pharaoh. We'll get back to that if we have, again, we've spoken about that in the past, the idea of strengthening the heart of Pharaoh. And it says then when Pharaoh asks you for a mofes, in sentence 9, so kach es matcho, take the staff when Pharaoh asks you for vehashleich lifnei Pharaoh, yehi lesani. And that staff that you go ahead and it will become a crocodile, a snake or crocodile. So it says that Moshe and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and sentence 10, and they did as God had said. V'yilisanin, it became a crocodile. But in sentence 11, it says that Pharaoh called the Chachomim and the Mechashlim, and they did the same thing. The Medrash says even little children he brought along, and they were able to do the same magic. He says, what are you kidding? I mean, you're bringing in a big, if this is the best that you can do, you know, what are you showing your wares? But the MS, when we think into it, what was the idea of making a staff into a crocodile? It must have had some symbolism. If it was just the idea to show that God masters nature, so why should this be considered a greater mastery? God knew that they're going to repeat that. What was the significance of that? So some point out a very interesting idea, that it had a different message. It had a different message. Going back to the question of free will, a question the Rambam said, we'll discuss later perhaps, why did God punish the Mitzrayim? He punished the Mitzrayim because they made the children of Israel work hard. But God had already told Avram, Bibriz Bein Apsorim, at the covenant, he said that your children will be Gerim, and the Yavidu V'yanu Osam. They will afflict them, and they will punish them. So all the Egyptians were doing were fulfilling the Gzerah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the decree of God. So there are various answers that are given. But the Ravid answers that all God said was V'inu Osam. The Inuaisom means what? You afflict them, but not the Porach, not to break their backs. That means that they could have been strangers, you could be a stranger. Inui is a very interesting idea, you know, in human nature and what our life is. God forbid, we have sometimes tremendous problems and solace, and we have Inui from that. And then when they're, and we feel bad, emotions, you know, every person has a way that he feels bad. But sometimes you don't have any major problems. So what is your major problem? You get up in the morning and you can't find where you put your, and you're going out of your mind. You can't find where you put your pen. And it's like the greatest tragedy. And then when you sit back and think, well, it's kind of nausea, right? I mean, I can't find another pen. Boy, Hashem, everybody's well, everybody's alive, everybody's happy, it's a beautiful day, everything's going, so I'll take a different pen. Yet in your mind, where is that watch and where is that pen? And I displaced the business section and it causes you problem, pain. That's Inri. That's, so there are two types of Inri that you could have. I mean, they could have caused the Jewish people Inri by saying that no Jews allowed. That's an Inri. By saying that once a year the Jews had to do this. Right. But what did they do before it? They literally broke their backs. They went out of their way to go ahead and to do this anger, you know, to trouble them. For example, sometimes you can make somebody work. So at least when this monument is built, the person can walk by with pride and say, this is my monument. He was a slave, but at least this is something that he accomplished. But what the Jews did, they bring this famous story in Russia about a person who was condemned for 20, 25 years to go into hard labor. And his job was, they told him that his job was that he would walk around in a circle, and by walking around in a circle or leading a horse around in a circle, he would be turning a grinder, a big mill, a grinder which was grinding wheat. So he did this for 20 years, right? He is accomplishing something. There'll be wheat, people have what to eat. Then at the end, when he's released, they say, do you want to see what you accomplished during these 20 years? So they opened it up and there was nothing there. So that means for 20 years, that's the greatest Inui that could actually happen. So the Gemara brings down. They told them to do things that they would have no pleasure from. They told them to build Pison and Ramses. Now, what was Pison and Ramses? And the Gemara explains the word Pison, that the earth would capsize and open up, and the whole building would be swallowed in. Nothing would remain. So they went ahead and did futile work, which not only broke them physically, but it also broke them spiritually. So in order to tell them that they should have treated they should have treated the Jews with a staff, okay, but not to be a snake. The idea was that from the staff came out a snake. That was really the purpose, what Moshe showed power. So it's interesting how it happened. Leshua Slibe was there. He didn't contemplate this, but what did he do? He thought that this was just a question of magic. So he brought in his magic makers, and he reverted, and he showed that he can do the same thing. But in actuality, in truth, that wasn't the purpose. It was the purpose was for them to learn a lesson, and the lesson, it turned out really that they did not learn. Then he starts with the different makos. Let's take a look in chapter 8, verse 3. It says there, starting first with the tzav, and you notice it says teyes yotcha b'matecha. Tell Aaron to go ahead and to stretch out his hands on the various pools of water. And he was supposed to stretch out his hands not only on the Nile, but in all the directions, because if he would stretch it out like what he could show the Nile, then when all the other waters become blood, so Pharaoh will say it's some natural catastrophe. But the idea was that spread all over, so at least we'll give him to think that it wasn't a natural catastrophe. It was indeed because he was predicting that this tragedy will happen. So Aaron spread over Almeme Mitzrayim, and it says, Vatala Tzvardeya, the Tzvardeya came up, Vatchas, and it covered over the land of Mitzrayim. So what did the Chartumim do? They did the same thing. Vayalois Tzvardeyim al Eretz Mitzrayim. So they went ahead and showed the same Tzvardeya in Eretz Mitzrayim. So Medrash says that really there was one Tzvardeya, and this Tzvardeya, they would keep on hitting it. And the more you hit it, the more Tzvardeyim came out. So really there was only one Tzvardeya, and Vayalois HaTzvardeyim, and they took this one Tzvardeya and they kept on knocking. So the Steitler wrote like this, Chairi says, when the Egyptians who were smiting this, so when they kept on seeing, the more they hit it, the more Tzvardeyim kept on jumping out. So the natural order should be what? That you have to stop, right? If you stop knocking away at the Tzvardeya, so at least there won't be a proliferation. They won't come running out. But what does the Midah of the Kas say? When you're angry? No. Adarabit. the more it comes out, right? So the more you have to hit it, and the more you hit it, then the more it comes out. So he says, what happens? You really defeat the purpose. So the stipler says this is a musr. That means as an ethical teaching. He says that's human nature. And whenever there's a kash, or whenever there's a machlekes, he says, the best thing he says is not to respond. Say no kind. What'll be? All right. So it'll take a little while, at least akeya. But the more you go ahead, he says, and hit the tzvardeya, the more tzvardeim come out. And it's just endless, and there's no way to control it. So this is just an interesting thought that he has on the medrash of Vital Tzvardeya, B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. And then it continues. This was speaking there when the animals in the fields and so on, that there would be this devir, the plague. So it says there that God's hand, in verse 3, God's hand would be upon the property, all the property that you have, a very strong pestilence. And God will differentiate with sharpness between the children of Israel, the flocks of the children of Israel, and of the Egyptians. And they will not die, mikol, from none. That means not one animal belonging to the children of Israel will die. You notice the language in 4, v'lo yamu mikol, from any, libnei Yisrael dovor, nothing. But then in sentence 6 it says, v'yas Hashem es hadover hazeh, God did this, v'yomos kol mikne Mitzrayim, and all the flocks of the property of the Egyptians died, but mimikne Yisrael leimeis echor, not one was hurt, right? Nothing happened. Leimei sechot. They didn't lose any flocks at all. Now, if you look at 7, it says, Vayishlach Paro. Paro then responded. And he sent messengers. And he saw that Leimeis mimikne Yisrael alechot, that there wasn't even one. So God made his heart strong. So the question that they ask is, why does it say alechot? It says, Vihinei leimeis echot. Alechot means until one. Which would mean that one did die. And in fact, that's why it says, Vayichbad leiv Paro, as we'll see, that Pharaoh, as long as he saw that one died, so he already had an excuse. If leimeis ad echod, if no one, so then no one died. But once he saw that echod, that one died, so that already was enough, that was already an excuse. So what does it mean? The pasuk is contradicting itself. If it said nobody died, why does it say here ad echod? There's a famous interpretation of the Vilna Gaon, which has always been fascinating. The question is an obvious question. So he says the following. There was one person, and we know from later in Chumash, who was called the Megadev, the one who cursed Hashem. Now this Megadev, we said, his father was a Mitzri. The father was the Egyptian that Moshe killed because he had afflicted and he had consorted with the wife of this slave, and they had a child. So this is the Megadev who cursed the name of God later. Now this Megadev was an adult living here at this time. Now he had a Jewish mother and a Goyish father. Now before the Torah was given, if you had a Jewish mother and a Goyish father, there's an opinion, a strong opinion, halacha, the Chachmei Tzorfas, they're called the French rabbis, who said that before the Torah was given, you went after the father, the B'nai Ne'el. So therefore, the Megadev, according to them, since his mother was Jewish, so Pharaoh thought, and he grew up with the Jews, like that's why he claimed later he wanted a portion, he lived among the Jews. So Pharaoh considered him to be a Jew. So, but he really wasn't a Jew, he was an Egyptian. So therefore, he did lose his flock. So now, God had told Moshe in sentences 4 and 6 that no Jewish animals would be hurt, and Pharaoh had said, ad echod. It was true with the exception of one case, which was this case. So the Goyim said, this case was the Megadev. And this Megadev, according to us, was really considered not Jewish. But according to them, he was considered to be Jewish. So that's v'hinei leim ad echod. And therefore, because of this ad echod, so Pharaoh went ahead and he had a toyus and he made a mistake. But even when God gave him these magefis, and he gave him these makos, these afflictions were done really with much mercy. For example, the end of the chapter, when you're dealing that by the makas borod, the hail, So God, here when it comes to the animals, from the livestock they all died when it finished the Egyptians. Yet when the hail came on the land, how does it say in chapter 9, verse 30? It says there that Ve'ator Avadecha Yodati Kiterem Tiro Mitnei Hashem Elokim. I know yet, he says, that we're going to bring this hail, but the time has not come when you recognize your fear of God. So what was the punishment? The punishment, it says in 31, for even if the flax and the barley are smitten, because the barley was standing up and the flax was a stalk, but the wheat and the spelt were not smitten because they are always late in ripening. So why didn't God bring about a destruction so it'll ripen later, so destroy the seed? Why did he bring about a destruction only on the Pishta and the Seira, which in a sense can mislead the Egyptians again? Because they'll say that what? That maybe the Pishta and the Seira was a bad seed, but you see, nothing happened to the Chitim. Yet God didn't bring about a destruction of the Chitim. So if you notice, it says there, how does it describe God in sentence 30? Mipnei Hashem Elokim. It uses two appellations and two descriptions in sentence 30 for God. Now, why does he use here Hashem Elokim? It should say Mipnei Elokim. Why Hashem Elokim? Because really they say the name of Hashem and Elokim also means mercy and judgment. Elokim means absolute justice, and Hashem is mercy. So God dealt here with the Egyptian people in a merciful manner. Because if all of the grain would have been destroyed, all of the wheat would have been destroyed, they would have all starved, the whole country would have gone under. The livestock could be destroyed as long as you could eat a piece of bread, a glass of water, you could live. But if they would go ahead and they would destroy the essence, the bread, or whatever, the people wouldn't have any nourishment. So he didn't want to do that. So that's why it was both Din and Rachamim. Din means that the punishment is to come about. But at the same time with the Bora, when there was Din, there was also Rachamim, compassion and mercy, and therefore they left over the major food, the wheat that was necessary, so that really was left over. Now, these are parts of the plagues that are mentioned here, but what was the purpose of the 10 plagues? We find all of the various commentaries and Midrashim, which teach us reasons and the significance of all the 10 plagues. And basically what they're saying is that it's like midah keneged midah, that it's like one means to pay back for what the Egyptians had done wrong. Now, just to chose one or two interpretations, for example, the Abarbanel, who gives a very interesting interpretation. He says that the 10 makos that we had here were very directly decreed from God. Midor keneged midor. For example, he goes through Dam. The waters became blood because they took the Egyptians put the little children into blood, into the waters, and they bloodied the waters with human life. The Tzvardayim. Tzvardayim scream and quack. So the idea was that the mothers, when they had to put their children into the, when they took the babies and threw them into the rivers, so their mothers were crying out like Tzvardayim, but nobody listened to them. Then he continued with the idea of Kinin. Kinin. Kinin means vermin and lice that come from the earth. They made the Jews go ahead, Vaymoras Chayehem, and they made them make bricks and mortar from the dirt itself. So in response to that, they had the Kinin. Oro, like the mixture of all creatures. The Egyptians used to flock down into Jewish homes and they would take their children and make slaves out of them and do whatever they wish. So the Orev also came into the houses of the Egyptians and did also damage to their own desire. Now the Dever killed out all of their crops because they used to go ahead and steal whatever livestock the Jewish people had. Shechin was the, what is Shechin? Shechin was the boils, because the Mitzrayim would go ahead and keep on, and they considered the Jews like despicable, you know, because it said that the outcasts They didn't even want to eat with Yosef to a degree. No Jews are allowed in their social environment. So for that, king, that you go ahead and hide yourself in the house. And this is the way he continues throughout each one of the makas. Arbe is because they used to steal from the fields of the Jews. So therefore the Arbe ate up all of their... Cheshef is because when the Jews were in Golos and Mitzrayim, Golos is depicted as Cheshef, as darkness. So therefore, they were paid back in the same vein. Now, Paro said, and then we have the Makos that are also, it's interesting, just one more interpretation on the 10 Makos, what it symbolizes is the, again, the Stipler went through the idea of the Makos on his own. What is the lesson that we could learn? So he says, that lesson that we can learn is that God has dominion over everything. And he goes through the makos in that way. Dam, blood. Dam, blood, meaning that Hashem has the power over water. He could turn it into blood. Kriyas Yamsuf. We also say that he showed his power over the yam. And that the water became like a barrier for their, a wall for their salvation. By Tzvardeya. Tzvardeya comes from the water, the crocodile, so therefore God shows that he is over the brios, over the creations in the water, the creatures of the water. By Arbe, so we see that Hashem is over the wind, because the Arbe came, a wind brought this in. And Makas Dever, so you see that Hashem is over the life of the Balei Chai and Mavola. So he goes through each one of these Makos. And this was to show Pharaoh that God is Hashem, who has total control over everything that he created. Because what did Pharaoh ask? Mi Hashem, Asher Eshma Bikolo. When Moshe came to him originally, he said, who is this Hashem? See, if he would have told Pharaoh, that's a whole discussion of its own, he would have told Pharaoh, the God of the Hebrews came to me. Pharaoh would take, why not? There are 80 gods, there are 100 gods, there's many gods. You have your own little God. But Moshe came, Hashem. So Pharaoh stood up and asked, Mi Hashem Asher Eshma B'Kolo? Like he's challenging God. Who is God? So the Ari said, he really didn't know, the Ari, Kabbalistically said, he really didn't know what those words meant. He said, because the Gematria, you know, we take the Makos and we divide it into Tzach, Adash, Bacha. Now, why do we divide it? There are reasons given. But the Gematria, the numerical count of the Tzach, Adash, Bacha, so the Ari says, comes out to the word Asher. Asher is the same numerical count. So Pharaoh said, Mi Hashem, Asher, who is the God that I will listen to him. So in a sense, he spoke and he didn't know what he said because he's the God of the Tzach, Adash, and Bachab. And the God of the Tzach, Adash, and Bachab is not like they had their God over this, the fertility and the water and so on, but this is the total master of creation. So at the end, you will see this God who is the total master of creation. Now, we do see also, how long did these makas take? I mean, all of this, it took a whole year. The makas took really a whole year. The Medrash, there's a dispute in the Medrash, one said that the maka lasted for 24 days, and then he would warn them, of 24 days he would warn them, and then the maka would last for 7 days. Another opinion is the other way around, that 7 days he would warn him, and for 24 days the makah lasted. So if you go ahead and you take 10 makahs and some 31 days, it was almost a year. So all of this deliberation went on for a year. And Pharaoh stood up, shows you the ritzicha that he had within him, the hate for the Jews and the arrogance that he had within him, that he stood up for an entire year without and suffered these makos. The total land was destroyed. You could just picture what the Rishus is. I mean, we saw, like, if you want to liken it to something, you could look at the example of Iran and Iraq in the war. Total decimation that was brought. And you saw, I mean, everything from germ warfare to almost atomic destruction and everything. But the hatred within the person and the arrogance did not let him humble himself. So this really was what Pharaoh was ready to go through everything by saying, Mi Hashem Asher Eshma Bekol.
After thrice experiencing their lack of power, the magicians humbly acknowledge that this is Etzba Lakim, and they disappear from the story. Because Etzba Lakim means, just as a plague sent from God is called Nega, we say the word Negoim, Nega. Nega means touch. So does the expression Etzba, the finger of God, also mean touch. Because a finger is the way that you touch things. So what does it mean by touching? It says both look at it from the point of view that God lets ordinary illnesses occur by means of ordinary laws of physical nature. In these, God does not appear in direct contact with man. But in certain instances, the Goyim are direct touches of God's finger. And the Goyim, he says, are direct touches of God's finger. The former, where it is only nature that is directly governing, Egyptian art imagined or claimed to be able to master nature. But before the direct power of God, they felt they could bow their heads without shame. So that means they didn't think that this is so terrible. This was Etzba Elokim, the direct power of God. Therefore, they're dealing with the direct power of God. They're bowing away because they're not going anymore with plain nature. Yet it seems that even if it was the direct power of God, perhaps Pharaoh did not take too much heed to it, because it showed perhaps that in this way God has power. It doesn't mean that he could totally, you know, have control over everything else. Perhaps it was limited only in this kind of a situation, and he was hardened. So what does God tell him a little bit later in sentence 18? God tells him, says, warn Pharaoh, and this is the second grouping. Now again, we said the second grouping of Adash is also a Gerus, a stranger. What's going to take care of the stranger? The first time it was what? The blood. Now what's going to take care of the stranger in place of the blood? We're going to have Oro. Oro is a mixture of wild animals. So he tells him to go to Pharaoh. Pharaoh is going by the water. But look at sentence 16. Go to greet Pharaoh in the morning. We're starting the second grouping of Gerus. But he says, go to greet him. He is going to the water. But this is different than previously. Previously in chapter 7, sentence 15, let me read it. It says, go to Pharaoh in the morning. He is going to the water. Stand and greet him by the side, by the brink of the river. Here he doesn't say, go to the brink of the river. Here he just says, go to Pharaoh in the morning when he's going to the water. But it doesn't say anything about standing at the brink of the river. Because the first punishment was going to be on the river. That means the river was going to become blood. The second punishment here is not dealing with the river, it's dealing with the earth. In fact, everything in the second grouping is dealing with the earth. Oro, Deber, and Shechin. These are all things we'll see of the earth. What is Oro? Oro is a mixture of wild animals. Now, let me quote him. He says that here Moshe was to forestall Pharaoh going out is to seek him in his home so that he can realize that the river and the soil can remain unaffected. And if it's God's will, there is nevertheless no staying in the land for the Egyptians. Not only that it takes their lifeblood away from the river that they feel like strangers, but forget the river. Even in your own home, on the sea, God can make you have the same lesson, the same misery. Because what was the Oro? Oro was a mixture of wild beasts. Now, animals of the wild by themselves really have the courage to attack human beings, but it's God's will that has implanted in them a certain timidity towards man. Like in Bereshit, it says that, you know, that you will, after the change, when there was an enmity between them, but there was a certain fear that they had. And it is only this timidity and restraint from invading the precincts of man that allows an ever-increasing space to be won for human development. When you think, it's interesting, you know, as you supposedly approach more of their territory, the wild beasts move away. We're afraid of blood, these wild beasts, yet they do have this certain timidity when there's a populated area. They move away. Why? Because God has given them, this is part of nature. But Hashem, he says, has only to remove this restraint to show that denial on the fertility of the soil can remain like it was. Yet the inhabitants of Egypt who consider themselves irrevocably fixed to their land, and everybody else were strangers, and they came from the Mayflower, they must depart the land. The whole of Egypt is nothing, only an oasis run from the surrounding desert. And God had only to not, and the wild invades the land. So now he's going to work with them from the land and show them that in the land itself, they could end up really being as strangers. That was the Orov. Then, of course, after the Orov, we have the Deber, which is the plague. The plague is also to show them, you know, the form the plague also had to do with undermining their feeling of superiority. It says Deber comes. What does the Deber do, the plague? It killed all of their life blood, their animals. It says it killed the horses, which was the whole pride of Egypt. It killed their asses, their camels, the beasts of burden that bear their possessions, their cattle, their flocks, their real riches. Because the idea that, as we said, the Tzvadeya took care of the superiority of their race. That taught them that they're not superior. Now, we said there's also superiority that comes from position and arrogance that comes from wealth. The Deber took care of that because it wiped out all of their wealth and so on. And the same thing, the last one that we're going to have in the third grouping of Aptus was the Arbeh, which was the Arbeh which came along and took care of all the riches of the fruit and the produce. So now we have the idea of the Deber, and as we say, the Shechin was the third Makir, which came as what? As a punishment, where they had all of these boils came along as a punishment. Chapter 8 finishes with the wild animal. Pharaoh said to Moshe, go ahead and serve your God. So Moshe said, we have to go away for 3 days and so forth. So Pharaoh said, I'll send you, but don't go too far away. And Hatiru Badi, pray for me. Now, if you notice, how did he speak here? He was a little more convinced, wasn't he? Because previously, by the Tzvadeya, if you recall, by the Tzvadeya, the second one, he told Pharaoh, he told Moshe, get rid of the Tzvadeya and I'll send you. So Moshe figured that really, he said he had to show him a further miracle, he figured, because he wasn't convinced. He said, why wasn't he convinced? Because he first said, get rid of the Tzvadeya and then I'll send you. But if you look at the way the structured sentences here in chapter 8, when he's dealing with the Orov, you look at sentence 21. By Orov, in chapter 8, sentence 21, here it says, Pharaoh called Moshe and Aaron. He didn't say, pray to me, but he said, go and serve your God. In sentence 22, Moshe gave him some of the conditions. In sentence 23 and 24, they debate the conditions. And then first, Pharaoh mentions at the end of 24, Atiru Badi, pray for me. It wasn't like previously by the second Tzvadeya, where the whole idea was pray for me, and just as an addendum he said, I'll send you. Here he already got into all kind of diplomacy, conditioning, but we got a gist of what the Makos were.